Let me remind you why you were put on this earth. You were put on this earth to be an influencer. Read. Do you know most of the Christian church does not read anymore? And if you don't read, you can also listen. If you don't have an Audible account, there's something wrong with you. What I'm saying is I can go through about a book a week because I'm the slowest reader in the world, even slower than you. So find a way to read or listen to good literature. With that, Dr. Richards, where are you?
I'm back here.
Okay. Yeah. He's hiding behind me. You're on.
All right. Thanks so much.
Right. Our way through the questions, right? We're already at the point where carbon dioxide, this sort of a warming effects of carbon dioxide, it's mostly saturated, at least until we double it. So let's say we're at 400. So what that would mean is that we would need to double it, get to 800 parts per million, just based upon the kind of physics of the greenhouse gas properties to increase the surface temperature another degree. And then you'd have to go from 800 to 1600. So you see how the diminishing returns works. So if that's true, and we've been going in the last 150 years only from, maybe 250 to 400, what's causing the warming? I skipped that because it was too complicated. I'm sorry, but I had it memorized. So there is an interesting correlation between cosmic ray influx, solar activity, and the temperature variation. And so, as you can tell, it's complicated because you've got solar activities, and there's something called total solar irradiance, so everything that comes from the sun. But then you also have cosmic rays that come from the universe and come from the galaxy, all right? And so you can think of our solar system as like a series of shells. And so the surface of the Earth, we're not just exposed to outer space. We have an atmosphere, and then because of the geological activity, there's a dynamo inside the Earth that creates a protective electromagnetic shield around us. And so as a result, if we didn't have that, solar particles and radiation by itself would strip off the atmosphere. And so what you need is a kind of protection from certain types of things that the sun does, but then also access to the warming energy of it, all right? But then the sun itself also creates a kind of shield, right? So there's a sort of shield around our solar system that interacts and protects us from cosmic rays as well. And there is an interesting correlation between temperature variation on the Earth and the variation of cosmic and solar rays and the way these interact, and a well-understood mechanism by which these factors change the cloud cover on the Earth. So remember I told you that water vapor is by far the most important greenhouse gas, and that is, in fact, sensitive to things like the solar irradiance and the cosmic rays, right? So we could be very well that the vast majority of this warming at this point isn't actually from the CO2. It's from these other variables. All right, so you might be wondering about the climate models then. So why is there this prediction that slight incremental increases in CO2 are going to lead to radical greenhouse gas effects? And so what you're looking here is a complicated figure. But I want you to focus on a couple things. First, look at the background, all those dotted lines that are scattered everywhere, called a spaghetti plot. And so what those are is those are different predictive climate models. And so if you've wondered, okay, so how is it that scientists are predicting what's going to happen in 2050 and what's going to happen in 2100? They don't have a time machine. And you can measure past climate. We don't have a way to measure future climate. So what they do is they use very complex computer models, and models, they, again, don't have thermometers on them from the future. You plug in assumptions into your model, theoretical assumptions, and then you run it out and say, okay, if all of this is true, what we plugged into the model, all the variables, what will happen? And so the models overwhelmingly favored by the UN committee predict a certain amount of warming. All right, and so that's where the kind of scary scenarios, even though in their case it's something like between 1 and 5 degrees centigrade, which actually isn't catastrophic, but that's the basic idea. All right, and so what the red line is, the sort of wobbly red line, that's the sort of average of all the models that the UN favors. And then the straight line is it just sort of perfectly smooth, so you can see the slope of the line. All right, so that's what they predict. And notice they all converge on 1979. So why is that, do you think? So they converge because that's when the satellites went online. And so all the models presuppose, okay, well, that's the data we have. So we want to assume everything about the past and the present and then run a model. And then how do you test a model? Well, the only way to test it is to say, okay, here's the prediction, and then you wait and see what happens, right? That's how you test it. But what they're wanting us to do is, based upon the models, completely change and reorganize our global economy based upon the predictive models. And if you followed COVID, predictive models have a very, very bad record of doing anything good unless they're tested. What they do is they just simply reveal the assumptions of the modeler. All right, now what's the green line? Right, so we've got a couple of different green lines. You see it says, thanks to John Christie at the University of Alabama, Huntsville. Anyone here last night, I told you, that's a NASA facility. Well, that's where the weather satellites are monitored, and John Christie's one of the guys that does this. So this is his data. What the green is that's what the satellites have measured. And so what do you notice between the green and the red line? Are they the same? The red line is a much steeper slope. So in other words, all the models the UN is using predict far more warming than it has actually been observed. What's actually been observed is what you would expect the warming to be based upon what I just told you about this effects of carbon dioxide with diminishing returns. What they're assuming is they're assuming something about so-called climate feedbacks. So they're not saying, well, the CO2 by itself is going to cause the catastrophic global warming. They'd grant the point I made earlier. But they say, it has other effects on the climate, and that's going to lead to catastrophic runaway greenhouse effects. And so if a feedback is positive, that just means it amplifies the effect of something. And if a feedback is negative, it means it dampens the effect of something. So let me give you a sort of climate example. So if you melt ice, remember I told you ice reflects more solar energy back into space than water does, or the oceans. And so if you melt an ice cap and turn it into an ocean, now all of a sudden the Earth's absorbing more energy, right? So it's going to be warmer, and so it's going to melt more ice, and you end up with more water, which is going to make it warmer. That's the idea. That would be the idea of a positive feedback in which a little bit of CO2 leads to some major effect. And then that's where all the work is. So if you're wondering, where's the controversy? Like, Jay, you've told us a lot of science. Where's the controversy? It is right here. 95% of the action in argument is based upon what are the nature of these feedbacks? And so what the UN does is that they assume all the feedbacks are basically known and that they all amplify the effects of the CO2. And if you do that, your assumptions are going to be that slight amounts of CO2 into the atmosphere are going to have drastic effects because you've assumed all the feedbacks are positive, so they amplify it. But what if some of them are negative? Right? What if some of them actually balance out? Right, have a sort of other effect. So when you're young, I think that this will speak to most of you. So when I was in high school, I stupidly ran track, and I was tall and skinny. So I was 6'3", 137, and I could not put weight on. And so this is the private torture of high school boys, right, is being too skinny. And so you know what I would do? I would eat entire pints of Häagen-Dazs ice cream. I would eat half a can of Jif at night. I would drink bulking protein shakes. 137, didn't budge. Just nothing. Now, I got fidgety and really hot. So what was happening? Was I violating the second law of thermodynamics, putting a bunch of energy and then, no. What was happening is that my metabolism was just adjusting to make up. It wasn't saying, I'll just add some muscle. No, it didn't do that. It would just speed up the amount of energy that it was consuming. And so it dissipated all those extra calories in terms of heat and physical activity. That's a system that's wanting to sort of reach equilibrium, right? So you see the idea? So a body's ability to increase its metabolism is a negative feedback. So if your metabolism, your high school boy metabolism, You don't get fat when you eat Häagen-Dazs ice cream. You stay the same and you just get hot and fidgety, right? But now it turns out, because of the fall, I assume, that feature peters out at about age 20. And then you discover, oh, okay, I can gain, no problem here. All right, so that's the idea. If you want to know, this feedback thing is complicated, right? That's a negative feedback. Your body's adjusting what it does with the energy to keep you at the exact same weight in that case. All right, so the question is, is the Earth's climate on a razor's edge so that if we just add a little extra CO2, there are all these things that just kind of go crazy, and all of a sudden there's this runaway greenhouse effect and the water boils off and, the ocean surfaces all just completely engulf the continents and things like that, or not? Or do the feedbacks balance themselves out? That's what the data from the satellites suggests. That there's, whatever the feedbacks are doing, they're mainly, they're neutralizing each other. And the only real effect is this slight warming effect of CO2 and other things. And it's not anything that we absolutely have to worry about. That's where all the action is. All right, now I know that might seem complicated, but if you're wondering where's all the action in the debate, it's actually not with the carbon dioxide, it's with the feedbacks. Now, this is what I mentioned. I flipped the order of this from some dumb reason. But as I mentioned, there is a correlation between cosmic rays and temperature. And those are the plots. And that's a picture of where we get the data. Tree rings and stalagmites, believe it or not. All right. Question 3. So the question, is it warming? We're at a slight warming trend since 1850. Sort of interrupted by a cooling trend from the 1940s to 1970s that is utterly unremarkable, not only from distant geological time periods, but just from human history of the last 2,000 years. We're well within the range of natural variation. Are we causing it? Well, we're likely contributing a little bit to it with CO2. We're also contributing to it with parking lots and lots of different things. But there's no evidence that it's at any kind of catastrophic effect. Even if what you said 100% of the warming is the result of human activity, you've seen the satellite readings. It's actually very, very modest. And there's no evidence that there are these climate feedbacks that are going to just blow the whole thing up. If there were, we would see that in the geological records. We would find records of past runaway greenhouse effects in the past when there was much more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere than there is now. All right, so number 3, is rising CO2 and warming bad? Well, y'all are in Montana. You know the kind of basic answer here. CO2 is plant food. So everything in that meadow, right, it depends upon carbon dioxide for life and for photosynthesis. We expire oxygen, right, carbon dioxide. 2/3 of carbon dioxide is oxygen, and plants use that, combine it with a carbon molecule, and that's how they actually metabolize. It's absolutely crucial for photosynthesis, supports all life on Earth, which you know, right? And did you know that if you get below 150 parts per million, plants can't prosper? So that's like the zone of death. So if you're wondering, is there a lower bound that you wouldn't want to go below for carbon dioxide for photosynthesis, it's about 150 parts per million. And so we're actually, if anything, kind of carbon dioxide starved. I know that sounds heretical, but there's lots of reason to think that, in fact, if you're thinking about plant growth, more atmospheric carbon dioxide would be better. This is a scientist named Idso who has done a lot of seminal work on this. And so what they do, he and his son, is that they take plants, like a certain kind of a pine, for instance, right, a bristlecone pine or something like that, and then they put it in little different greenhouses, and one will be just like the regular atmosphere, and then they'll increase to 150 parts per million the carbon dioxide and do this with different plants. And notice what happens. The same species of tree at different concentrations. Look how much larger it is on the right. On the top, that's actually rice as well. It's really well understood. My daughter, 1 year, our daughters went, we were living in the country 1 year outside Seattle, and they went to a public school this 1 year. And my daughter was in had the science fair. And I said, let's test the effects of carbon dioxide on plants. And so we used wheatgrass and put them in clear containers. And it turns out you could see the green, but what we did is we had it in clear containers. And you can't imagine what it did to the root growth. It doubled the thickness of the roots just for the increase in CO2. It wasn't a very popular thing in Washington State, needless to say. So, yeah. All right, and so what would you think would happen on the surface of the earth if this is true? Now, different plants respond differently. Some are sort of hyper-responders, some respond only a little bit. But in general, plants are more prolific with increases in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So what would you expect if we've been adding CO2 to the atmosphere for several decades would happen on the Earth? Well, this has actually been studied. So this is a NASA study by Zhu et al., and there are several others that are like this. So this is basically a comparison. It's called the Leaf Area Index. And what this is a sort of analysis of wavelengths in which you're literally looking at how much green appears from the surface of the Earth over time. Right, and the main source of green is, of course, plants. And so if this effect is happening globally, what you would expect is that the leaf area index, the Earth would be getting greener over time. But you probably only ever hear about something that's happening to the Brazilian rainforest. You will never hear NPR tell a story about this, even though this is a NASA study. Now, the New York Times and some have covered it, but it sort of creates cognitive dissonance for people, so you don't hear much about it. And so this is a study from this one in 2023. It was from 2000 to 2023. And so essentially what you're seeing is the red are the places where it's gotten less green for various reasons, either a drought or maybe farming practices. So there's some of that. And then green to dark green is where you have gotten much more green. So what predominates there? Green. So the Earth has gotten between, maybe 15 to 20% greener. And the primary hypothesis for this is aerial fertilization of carbon dioxide. All right, so if you're wondering, is it good or bad? Well, adding CO2 to the atmosphere, at least for plant growth, at least at this level, is pretty good. Okay, this is another complicated plot you don't need to worry about. But what I want you to see is that these are basic models based upon other data sets to try to figure out, okay, what's the CO2 concentration at different times in the distant past? The line of death, as I told you, for plants is 150. And the main thing you need to notice as you go from the present back to the past, right, and this is based on different measurements, this is the carbon dioxide parts per million. So remember I told you we're at maybe 420? It's gotten up to 6,000 parts per million, right, in the past, with no catastrophe. So it would be somewhat warmer, probably, but it would be a lot greener, and it would in no way be an actual catastrophe. All right, so the other thing, and I could bore you to death for an hour on this, remember the prediction is that warming will cause catastrophic climate changes. And climate changes like far more hurricanes and cyclones, far more intense hurricanes and cyclones, far more and far more intense tornadoes, all that kind of stuff, right? All of this data is available online, and I'm going to summarize it for you. There is no trend at all of increasing intensity and frequency of any of these things. It's just not true. These are predictions of the model, but when the media gives you a story about a hurricane, it is pure propaganda in which they're picking a weather event that happens and using it as an illustration for macroclimate change. So this is just one slide showing this. So this is the count of major tornadoes, so bad tornadoes, F3 to 5, over time. So you'd expect if increasing carbon dioxide and temperature, right, is causing, say, more intense, more frequent tornadoes, you would see a correlation, but you don't see it at all. In fact, from 1954 to 1987, if you average those, it was 54 a year, and if you take 1988 to 22, average of 34 a year. So if anything, the trend is kind of, at the moment, in the other direction. Now, I think what's actually happening is that these things just vary over certain time scales, and probably the variations in temperature aren't making a huge difference. So there's no evidence that it's actually bad, at least the amount of moderate warming that we have. And it's certainly not bad for people in the north whose land prices and property prices might go up, you know. Now, maybe if you're in Southern California, you'd be sort of grumpy about that. But here's the kind of key question. If you're saying, well, is it bad that the earth is warming and we're causing it? What's the optimum global temperature? Does anybody know? Nobody knows. No one has gotten the Nobel Prize for determining the optimum global temperature. How would you calculate that? Well, you'd have to take account of all the effects, good, bad, and indifferent for different at different temperatures, right? Now, we can say if we're talking about human well-being and life, it's somewhere between 0 and 100 degrees centigrade, right? We know it's in there, and it stands to reason that, yeah, if we're way out from where we are now, at some point, it's possible that the cost will exceed the benefits. But there's no reason to assume that moderate warming in the near term is, on balance, bad. They're just sort of counting on you to assume that, even though you know that that's not true. In fact, far more people die of cold than die of heat. And this has been true historically. And so the only way you could sort of answer the question, yes, it's bad that there's warming, is if you knew what the optimum global temperature was, and then you knew where we are. And if we were moving away from it, that would be bad. But what if it's up here? Then that means that we're moving toward it, right? And so it's actually a very complicated question. And even the UN predicts a century out that the moderate warming that we're experiencing right now is on balance better rather than worse economically. It's just that they think 80 or 100 years out, based upon the predictive models, that's when it's going to get bad. But you can see how much stuff there is here in this really simple claim about climate change. And then there's these kind of questions, okay, are things getting worse? Climate-related disasters and deaths from those are down basically 99% over the last century, despite the fact that we build far more things in places like floodplains and Hurricane Valley in Florida, right? Mainly because we've learned to adapt to it. They haven't gotten more expensive in principle. We do spend more on it because insurance covers things. And so you can't say, well, you know, there's a lot of property damage in Florida now than there was 80 or 100 years ago. There was no air conditioning 100 years ago. There weren't a lot of folks in Florida, right? So when you're building condos on the edge of the ocean in a hurricane zone, you're going to expect more kind of damage. That tells you nothing about what's happening in the climate. All right, same thing with wildfires. Weirdly, the trend is actually on balance, right? Not in any particular place. Some places are worse than others. There's no obvious trend. And then, of course, if you do sort of global metrics and life expectancy and financial effects, there is a direct correlation between increase in CO2, warming, and human well-being. Whether they're causal or just correlative is another question. And then now we finally get to the policy. So let's say you said yes to all the questions. You said, yes, it's warming. Yes, we're causing it. Yes, it's terrible. There's still the policy question of, would anything that's like sort of politically feasible make any difference? And so the first attempt at this was something called the Kyoto Protocol, in which countries that signed on pledged to reduce their CO2 emissions to 5.2% below 1990 levels. Countries signed on to it. None of them did it. And so then the next one is called the Paris Agreement, which is sort of like that, but it just sort of updated it. And the only country that's partially complied with it, despite not signing it, is the United States of America, primarily because of the shift to natural gas, weirdly enough, because of fracking. And so now, guess what the proposed policy is? Net zero by 2050. So Kyoto Protocol and the Paris Agreements didn't work primarily because the guys that proposed it themselves said that if all the countries complied, it would make a vanishingly small difference in global temperature on their assumptions and cost the global economy trillions of dollars. So countries were incentivized to say they would do it and not do it, needless to say. Net zero is the idea that by 2050, we will no longer be adding any new carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, which is impossible. It is absolutely impossible. And it's got a massive PR campaign. This is it. 10 objectives, one goal, net zero. So here's an analysis by Richard Lindzen at MIT, Will Happer, physicist at Princeton, and Weingarten, actually at York University in Colorado, making the calculations of net zero, basically. So if you actually did this, by itself, it would actually make very, very little difference. So it would cost tens of trillions of dollars, probably hundreds of trillions of dollars, and it would make absolutely no difference. So as a result of that, what do you think the chances are that countries are going to freely comply with this? Basically zero. What do you think the chances are that China, which is still coming online and by far the greatest sort of, that's where the growth is in CO2 emissions, What do you think the chances that the communists in Beijing are going to comply with this? Zero. What do you think the chances are that the communists in Beijing would like other countries to do it? 100%, right? 100%. So this is just completely insane. No politician is ever going to be able to answer this question. The best they'll say is, well, this is a start. We got to start somewhere. So that's what they said with Kyoto. Well, we're going to need 99 more Kyotos. So we're going to need more catastrophe for very little effect. That's just stupid policy. Any policy, you want to say, okay, what are the benefits and what are the harms? And you want to increase the benefits and reduce the harms. This is just insane. And in fact, I'm tempted to say it's actually not about this. It's about something else. I think, without getting too conspiratorial, it's about controlling people's energy consumption. Because if you control their energy consumption, you control them, period. I think that's basically what we're dealing with. So, as I mentioned, the cost for the U.S., the U.S. alone, if this were to do it, would be something like $400 trillion, right, which is insane. It's also insane, but just for basic purposes of physics and energy density, that you're going to use basically windmills, because they don't want to do nuclear, which would be the one alternative. And so it's going to be windmills and solar. Huge amounts of energy in order to maintain and to build those things, highly reliant on rare earth minerals that China supplies, all just complete insanity. And then you need complicated ways of storing and backing up the energy. And there actually isn't even enough copper to do this. So that's insane. And as I mentioned, the largest contributions now are coming from countries that are still developing. So China there is in the red. So you can see from 1850 to the present, the U.S. is now down here. China has spiked for obvious reasons, and then Asia, other than China. Now, is that terrible? The greedy Asians are using carbon-emitting fuels? No, they got started in industrialization later than we did. And so I do not fault the Chinese or the Indonesians for using these sources of energy, especially when their per capita income is much, much lower. In fact, we know that as countries get wealthier, they become more interested in environmental cleanliness. And so when you're doing really well, like I'm at that stage where I'm doing detailed studies of red dye number 40, right? It's like, I'm going to pay twice for these cereals at Whole Foods because it just might be a problem with that dye and the other stuff, right? That is a luxury good, right? If you're worried about the snakes that are in the grass and where you're going to get the next meal for your kids, you're not worrying about, parts per billion of things in the atmosphere, all right? It's crazy. And this is just the basic reality, is that fossil fuels are a uniquely effective cost or source of energy. If you're interested in solar energy, we've got it. It's in hydrocarbons, right? It's been embedded. It's right here on the surface, and we're not anywhere near to running out if you include all hydrocarbons, so oil, natural gas, and coal. It's just uniquely energy dense. You can carry it. It's very stable for all the kind of obvious reasons. We're not using coal and natural gas and oil because we're unimaginative or have some weird attachment to it. We're doing it because it's abundant, and you know it's abundant because it doesn't cost $1,000 a barrel. If we were about to run out of it, it would be so expensive we'd be using something else now. The reality is that's why you have to kind of be coerced to go to other sources. And then I'm especially passionate about this because I spent the first year of COVID, 2020, with a couple of other obsessive compulsives writing a book about the economic costs of lockdowns. And it is very unsatisfying to say we were totally right. At all cost, no benefit. We were expecting, okay, that will maybe the lockdowns would slightly reduce the rate of infection, slightly, but we still thought, but the cost to that would be catastrophic, both in terms of lives lost and dollars. And it turns out once we did the statistical analysis, we've got all the states and all the countries that went into lockdown, what the case curves were, and when they opened up. And if you look at those curves, you are unable to guess when the lockdown started and when they stopped. In other words, the lockdowns, they skipped. It's like a rock skipping off the surface of the water. Zero difference. So it ended up being all cost and no benefit. This is what people do. This is what politicians and major transnational organizations do when they're following untested predictive models and then deciding what to do, which is what they were doing here. A completely ridiculous model from a ridiculous model at the University of London, who was a notorious over a period of 20 years of predicting vast pandemics that didn't work out. So don't trust them on their predictive models. So what should we do instead? All that's going to be useless. If we're actually concerned about the environment and human well-being, then help the rest of the poor part of the world become rich. This is just from 1990 to 2019, the total population of the world living in the way the UN defines absolute poverty, which is like $2 a day or something. But just think of absolute poverty. If you don't have basic shelter, if you don't have enough calories to keep yourself alive, if you don't have access to really, really cheap medicines that in the developed world people can get for $3, you're living in absolute poverty, right? And that number has gone down dramatically, but there are still a billion or so people in the world that have that. So if we're actually interested in the rest of the developing world getting interested in all these kind of environmental questions, help them become as rich as we are. And this is the basic reality. And African economists, by the way, are especially passionate on this. I met a UN delegate from Kenya last year at a UN event, and she said, my village, so if you're a UN delegate, you're in the elite, right? You're like in your country, you're in the top 1% of 1% of the elite. She said, my village just last year got a reliable electric grid. She said, I grew up with power going on and off. The poor need this stuff. Food requires energy. A third of the world still burns wood and dung for cooking, heat and cooking. So according to the World Health Organization, 4 million children under 5 years old die each year from respiratory diseases caused by indoor smoke. And there are a lot more depressing statistics where that came from. That's what we should be focusing on. And the reason especially we should be focusing on it is because the richer a country is, the more they are able to adapt to change. So we would, right, so what do? In the United States, we add insulation or move or get air conditioning, right? So the wealthier you are, the easier it is for you to adapt to change. And in fact, we've been doing this for decades. So this is a chart that shows you can't even see the global warming. So this is a degree centigrade change over time. So global warming for the last 120 years is basically flat. So the effect of warming, you can't even see it. But what this is the amount of change that people on average experience themselves over time. So over a 2-hour period, a 10-hour period, a 6-month period. Why 6-month period? That's the difference between the middle of the summer and the middle of the winter, right? Those changes in Billings, Montana are much more drastic than anything that we're talking about. It looks like you guys have survived it, right? So we know this. So for all some very obvious reasons, if we're actually concerned about the environment, if we actually think people should be able to be fruitful and multiply, we should be focusing on that. Help the poor who can't yet adapt to whatever the climate does in the future, be able to adapt to it as well as we can. And in the process, let's not destroy the global economy for really stupid reasons. Thank you very much. All right, so I don't know what's happening with my... My slideshow is taking on a life of its own here. So
First of all, we're going to take questions for a minute, but yesterday the president of Heritage had an article that I put on our Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you comment on that for a minute?
Yeah, so it's been complicated being at Heritage for the last year because the media decided to spend maybe $20 million attacking this effort. We just led. It's not just a Heritage thing called Project 2025, which involved a 900-page policy statement or document, 900 pages, which Heritage has been doing every year, every 4 years since 1980, of policy. Here's policies we think, you know, the next president should implement. But this time we got over 100 other organizations to do it with us. So there were basically 400 of us that contributed to this big document called the Mandate for Leadership. It was super secret, and so we hid it on the internet in April of 2023 at a website page called project2025.org, I think. And then we put the PDF free online. So this was deep secret stuff, right? But then we also have a database of about 10,000 people to help whoever becomes president, if they want it, be able to have people that they can pull from for a transition, because presidents have to appoint about 5,000 people. And so there's been a lot of weird stuff happen at Heritage, but there's also been some amazing opportunities. First, our president, Kevin Roberts, was invited to speak at the World Economic Forum this winter. And we thought, that's interesting. What do they want to do here? And we thought, they want to co-opt conservatives. So I could tell you that Kevin, if you watch what he did at the World Economic Forum, no chance of co-opting, right? He brought it. And so then last week, he was invited to a New York Times forum to talk about climate change, and he brought it. And so you can see his piece, I think it was at the Daily Signal the other day. So it's funny, I'm not actually the guy that does energy and climate at Heritage. We've got some genuine experts on this, but I have been tracking it and writing about it for, as I said, 20-some-odd years. And so I can tell you there are no new arguments. There's new data. You have to kind of stay up with the evidence. But once you get the basic structure of the argument, it hasn't changed at all. The same kind of talking points, the same non sequiturs, the same exaggerations. And so if anything, I've gotten more skeptical of the details. This is what happens. You get radicalized. You know, this is what Joe Rogan said. He said, until 3 years ago, I thought vaccines were the greatest thing ever, and now I don't think we even went to the moon. I mean, you know, there's a danger of overcompensating, of course. But a lot of this, I initially thought, okay, we're probably the main cause of it, the warming. It might be bad, but we kind of need to look at it. And some other things. I've actually gotten more skeptical of all the details than I was when I first started studying this. So,
comment on the fact that one of his bottom lines was how much this is being pushed by the elite and really hurting the poor.
Oh, absolutely. So if you just look at aerial photographs of Davos during the World Economic Forum, practically everyone there comes on a private jet. To harangue the rest of us who are flying coach, you know, or maybe not even flying at all, which kind of tells you that they're not serious. They're still buying houses in Malibu. If you're really worried about sea level rising, you would not be doing that. And so in my mind, part of this is there's lots of young people that just get captured by this stuff and they genuinely believe it and they're sort of tricked. Then there's maybe some true believers among the elites that just have sort of totally convinced of this. But I think a lot of this is cynical because at least the people that are doing themselves things that would make a difference, I'm inclined to take them seriously. James Lovelock, for instance, is a scientist that came up with the so-called Gaia hypothesis. He's very much over on the left. He's really worried about this, but he said, we have to get serious about nuclear power. Okay, I take Lovelock seriously. If somebody tells me we got to go net zero by 2050 and we're going to do it all with solar panels and windmills, that's just not serious. That's just the stupidest thing ever. That tells me this person doesn't know math and physics. That's just what that tells you. And so that's the kind of reality is we're dealing with elites that exempt themselves from the rigors that they expect the rest of us to endure.
Is the presentation you just did in one of your two books?
Not the presentation, obviously, but the argument is in a chapter of Fight the Good Fight. Yes, I have a chapter toward the end on climate change and then another chapter on energy itself. So I know Dick wants me to do this. So I don't like plugging my books, actually. It makes me feel very uncomfortable, but I know Dick wants me to do this. Buy them for the ministry, you know, yeah.
You know what? The motivation by the elites is to gain power through this. Then who benefits from that? Like if the UN is behind it, like what political organization benefits from the power?
Yeah, I mean, power is a weird thing because in some ways, I mean, the Lord of the Rings is very insightful about this. So the elves, when they're making the rings, I'm a Tolkien nerd. I wrote a book called The Hobbit Party, so I could bore you to tears. But they didn't want to make rings. Even though the elves made these three rings that gave them power and gave them a kind of immortality, the elves were more noble than humans. They didn't want men to have rings because they love power. And they said anything that gives them more power is just going to amplify this. And so I think if you don't understand that, you can't diagnose problems. Because if you think everybody does things for money, for instance, itself, I just finished last night The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich by William Scheer. I read it years ago. He was the American journalist on the ground in Austria and Germany throughout the buildup of the Third Reich and all of World War II on the ground. And he talked about this. I mean, Hitler had bunkers and things like this, and Hitler collected a bunch of art, but he was collecting it for a museum. There's no evidence that Hitler was motivated by just getting rich. He was motivated by his really bizarre demonic ideas of the good of the German people and himself. It was power. And that's what's happening here. And so I think when you're dealing with elites, the temptation is to think, oh, look at all these rich people, gathering. They're hoping to get richer. Sometimes that explains things. There is no way that Bill Gates is doing what he does because he wants to get richer. Because just like CO2, there is diminishing marginal utility with money, right? That first 75,000 is a big deal. The second 75,000 is pretty good, but you get to a few billion, it doesn't change your life. And so what happened is that Bill Gates was at one time the richest man on the planet. He shifted to philanthropy, and now he does a kind of, it's a kind of predatory philanthropy, unfortunately. He's done some good stuff. The Gates Foundation has done some good stuff, but now he's absolutely focused on empowering the UN and these transnational organizations. And so I think it's partly about power, and it's partly about a political vision that if humans are sort of allowed to be free and have more local control, that we're going to kill ourselves. And so we need some noble overlords to control us. And, they just happen to look like Bond villains, like Klaus Schwab. That's God giving us a hint. Like, it's not that subtle. But I really do. I think it's mainly power and plus a distorted kind of altruism in which they think we're going to destroy things if they don't control us. I think they believe that. And so that's why they exempt themselves, you see, because the rabble needs to be controlled. They sort of transcend it.
Actually, I've got one comment and a question. And the comment is, if you're really concerned about the environment, then you need to go nuclear.
Need to do what?
Need to go nuclear.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And the question is, it has to deal with from last night's lecture on the galactic habitable zone.
Yeah.
So my question is, if the universe is infinitely old, right, and given the calculated expansion of the universe, would the Earth, if the universe is infinitely old, would the Earth now be in a habitable zone in the galaxy?
So if the universe is infinitely old, then it would always have existed, and so everything, let's just assume that it starts off in some way that you could have a chemistry and planets. If it was infinitely old, we would have already reached a state of universal equilibrium an infinite amount of time ago. So nothing interesting. Fortunately, there's absolutely no evidence that the universe is infinitely old. It has an age, and so it's past finite. And there's no reason to assume that it's infinite in expanse either. And so it can seem like, gosh, if you're dealing with huge amounts of time and huge numbers of stars, that almost anything could happen. Actually, lots of things can't happen, even given massive amounts of time. We are where we are. Like all of those things, one of the functions is what happens over time. But nothing would be what it is now if the universe were infinitely old, unless somehow new matter was sort of popping into existence or something like that. But one of the reasons to, even if you didn't know that there's a cosmic background radiation and the galactic redshift, let's say you didn't know, had to have any evidence of that, the fact that we're still here and there's still radioactive decay of elements in the core of the Earth tells you that it hasn't been here forever. You might not have any idea how long it's been here, but there's plenty of reason. Believe it or not, the fact that the night sky is dark is itself evidence that it's not infinite in expanse.
Okay, couple questions. Knowing that there's a lot of conspiracy theories circulating.
Yeah, and the trick is to figure out which ones are real and which ones are bad.
And it seems waiting until the ones come to fruition, it seems it's like a deal. But there's a lot of talk about weather modification and that the powers are spreading heavy metals into the atmosphere to kind of reflect the sunlight, do you believe that that's a deal? And then the second question is I don't know if you're familiar with somebody named Ben Davidson, who talks a lot about solar flares, mm-hmm. and the electromagnetic barrier is weakening, and we're at risk for solar flares and that could be very devastating.
Okay, that's a bunch of stuff. So it has been talk of what's called geoengineering. And so the idea is, if you're worried about, you know, runaway climate change or runaway global warming, one way to affect that would be to increase the reflectivity of the Earth, right, or the atmosphere, by adding certain things into the atmosphere, certain kinds of compounds and elements. And so that's the idea. This has been proposed by some people. So far as I can tell, nobody's trying to do it, even though there's a lot of stuff online about people doing it. But if we were doing it, almost anyone with some Radio Shack materials could probably measure the effects of this. And I'm quite certain that the Europeans would not like it. So the European, if it were happening, I would suspect it here rather than in Europe, because they're fussy over there about what gets added to the food and the atmosphere. So yes, there's proposals for that. So far as I know, there's no evidence that I've seen. I know there's a lot of pictures of contrails online. That's not evidence. That's just pictures online of this, that anybody's doing this in any systematic way. Now, there are kind of local testings to see, okay, if we were going to do this, you know, which ones would be the least harmful and the most beneficial for reflecting it. I think it's just an insane idea. Now, yeah, it might make sense if there was some kind of catastrophe, but we have no idea all of the kind of knock-on effects of doing that, and we're really bad at anticipating unintended consequences. Okay, so solar flares. So, yeah, so there's always a relevant worry that we're going to have some kind of electromagnetic event from the sun that's going to drastically affect our electronics, basically, on the Earth. And the strength of the Earth's magnetic field varies over time, and in fact, the polarities flip over time, too. And so there's always a kind of worry about that, but there are also 11-year sunspot cycles that we track. And so I think that the best that we can probably do is sort of calculate the costs and benefits. Okay, what's the probability that this could happen on any particular year, and then how much does it cost for us to shield vital equipment and infrastructure from that? And that's just how you do policy, okay? You're not going to spend all your GDP on this for an event that might happen once every trillion years, right? Yeah. But if it's a real risk, you know, say 12 or 15 years out, it's something that we need to do something about. So that's where I would say that's where we should focus our energy. The military does this with some stuff. The other thing you can do is just get a 1978 Chevy Silverado pickup that's analog, and then you can hide a battery in a Faraday cage or something, and then that's the only thing you'll have to replace. All of our electronics, it's not shielded. If you have a major event, it would be a disaster.
Long time ago, or at least when I was in college and high school, we learned about the Van Allen belts.
Mm-hmm.
About, I'm going to say 15 years ago, there was a big scare about the ozone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the hole in the ozone layer,
right,
and all of a sudden refilling your air conditioner cost about 15 times what it normally would. And,
right,
you know, we banned all that.
Yep.
What role do those play in a habitable planet?
There are details of this that are not well understood. So the assumption, based upon not completely ridiculous ideas, is you get these chlorofluorocarbons in the atmosphere that create essentially kind of holes in particular locations on the poles, which can have a negative effect on life. And so that was why these were things we were using in our air conditioners and still do, and we were not sort of tending to, you know, you could drive around and have it leaking, and you just kept kind of getting the Freon added, right? And so we actually managed to reduce that globally just by kind of doing some simple things, and they did reduce it, and my understanding is that those holes shrunk. There's still a debate among the scientists about whether that was actually causal or coincidental. But people use that. Let's assume that the official story is exactly what happened. People use that as an excuse for, see, when we all work together and do what the UN tells us to do, great things happen. It's kind of like, how many people do you know that have smallpox and polio? None. All right, so here's 78 shots for your 2-year-old, right? It's like, wait, okay, maybe I want to spend some time on this. That's what they're doing. So they'll use things like this, or simple environmental cleanup, you know, like cleaning the air. CO2 is not a pollutant in the same way that sulfur dioxide is, or, you know, burning a particulate matter. It's not a pollutant. Now, yeah, it might at some concentrations have effects. We should look at the evidence of that. But it's only by sort of alighting from environmental cleanup, which is its own thing, to controlling CO2, that basically the climate change campaign gains the credit of earlier successful environmental cleanup campaigns that it has nothing to do with, just as the CDC gains the credit of what we imagine about polio vaccines and smallpox to like just surprise us with new things every 45 days or something. So just keep separate. If you can tell if there's anything I'm interested in, keep separate issues separate. Don't allow people, and don't do it in your own mind, to say, oh, well, I know this, I'm just going to assume that. You know, focus on these things one at a time.
Yeah, Jay, could you comment on, it was about 5-10 years ago, mm-hmm. Phil Jones, East Anglia, in England,
yeah.
Where they keep the climate.
Yep.
And Michael Mann,
yep.
University
this
of
was 2009.
Pennsylvania. Yeah, yeah. And Hansen.
Yep.
NASA, and they intercepted, hacked.
That's right.
Communication.
Yep.
And you know where I'm going.
I know where you're going. It was called ClimateGate. I was writing full time for the American Enterprise Institute on this at the time. It was the happiest. I was like a pirate that had wandered into Dragon's lair of gold and the dragon was dead. Because this is a bunch of data of us that were working on this. We knew these guys were manipulating peer review, killing, you know, completely destroy. Like if you're an editor at a journal that dared to publish an article by some guy at MIT that didn't toe the party line, they would do everything they can to destroy your journal and never publish again. And there's correspondence of them talking about it. It's all the shameless stuff that we all knew they were doing, all there for us to see.
Right.
The media didn't cover it well, of course, and so people forgot about it.
Yeah, and they perverted science.
Absolutely.
They don't get the information to go to a conclusion.
Yeah.
They start with the conclusion. Global warming mm-hmm. is right. We've got to control the world
yeah.
To prevent it. And then
everything follows.
It's backward science.
Absolutely. It's backward science. So I'm mostly focused on the modeling. A lot of the stuff that we found out there. Now, we know that models are only as good as the... In fact, I forget if it's Freeman Dyson or somebody said, give me 5 variables and I can make a model that will predict anything. You know, you tune enough dials to do this. But these guys are a lot of them that were actually responsible for the data because, you know, you've got all these ground measurements and then you've got satellite measurements. And so there's an office in the United States, an office in the UK that have separate data, theoretically. They're all colluding. But if you thought, okay, I wonder if there's a kind of peer review cartel here. It was utterly exposed for that. I mean, I must have written 50 pieces on this at the time because it was, I must confess, it's like a kid in the candy store. It's like, I told you, we knew it. But it's irritating because those guys, none of those guys have actually paid a price for that at all. In fact, Michael Mann is still in a now multi-decade lawsuit against Mark Stein, who dared to sort of call him a name. Went after the hackers instead of the scientists who were exposed. It was absolutely outrageous. I've got a piece online. If you Google Jay Richards, Politics Disguised as Science, it's a short essay, and it's 12 things you can consider. If you're a non-specialist and somebody's telling you that there's a consensus about science, some scientific issue, and you say, okay, well, I don't know how to study this. I'm not a specialist. Is there some ways I, as a layman, can decide whether to believe it or not? And so I gave 12 kind of key features about the sociological sort of surroundings. And one of them is a cliquish and controlled peer review process. Another is declarations of consensus before a real consensus could possibly exist. And there are 12 of these. And so it's sort of like, you know, like keys for discerning when the consensus is based upon careful consideration and when it's, you know, social pressure. And unfortunately, you know, scientists are humans, and humans are we're all social creatures, and so people fall for intellectual orthodoxies all the time. I can't believe how long this one has happened. In 2009, I thought at the time, oh, finally, we're going to have a rational debate about this. But it just continues. And it continues because the interest in keeping it alive are so strong that they just don't die.
Hey, Jay. I work for a big oil company, so mm-hmm. we can talk about a sponsorship later.
But, yes, exactly. I'll give you my card.
Okay, so I'm an engineer, mm-hmm. and I'm surrounded by other engineers and scientific people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, we see, you know, the storm coming for big industry, especially big oil.
Right.
And so everything that I see, all the development, everything is towards reducing our global, you know, CO2 footprint.
Yeah.
And it just burdens me because, well, one, because so much energy is put into non-energy, right?
Right. into dumb stuff.
Reducing energy. Okay.
Yeah.
And we realize, I mean, that we have the most affordable energy in the world because of our technology. And
absolutely.
Smart people spending time to develop very efficient processes, right, to make them the most use. Okay, that's kind of a preface. But do you have one go-to book or something that you would hand to a technical person say, this is something I recommend you read that brings to light the things that you've shared? I recently read a book by Michael Schellenberger.
Yeah, that's a good book. I know Michael.
Yeah,
like he's good because he's sort of on the left.
Yeah.
You know, he calls himself a refugee now. Mm-hmm. But his book, did it come out last year? I forget when it came out, last couple of years.
It's been a couple of years.
Yeah, that's really good. The book Unsettled by Steve Koonin, K-O-O-N-I-N, is really good. And it's just kind of analyzing. It doesn't talk so much about energy. It's just sort of analyzing the climate issue. And then, it's not up here now, but it's this guy. So Alex Epstein. Now, he's like a hardcore Randian libertarian, which I think kind of can turn people off. But he focuses on the sheer benefits of hydrocarbons and using these things and treats them as a blessing. So he makes a really strong, I think, persuasive case for the importance of using these things for human well-being. And if you think about it, you know, it's not as if it's just sort of there and was already useful. I mean, until a couple hundred years ago, anybody that had experience with oil coming up out of the ground, it was usually in their farm, and it was frustrating. It wasn't until we actually figured out how to refine it and use it for fuel and develop technologies that could use it efficiently for fuel that really kind of became a resource. And there's still a lot of this stuff. And so the only way that anybody's going to be able to persuade us not to use it is to tell us that we're going to destroy everything if we keep doing it, because otherwise the case for using it is so obvious. And we're really good at mitigating the cost in terms of environmental cleanup, in terms of getting lead out of the air, all this kind of stuff. We're good at that. And so that's why I just think they go after it. There is also, I can't say I'm absolutely certain, China wants us to weaken ourselves. Well, they don't do that, right? I can't begrudge them that, right? I mean, that's just, they're acting rationally. And so they have every interest in us propagandizing ourselves. Because first of all, then we have to buy the rare earth minerals from them for the windmills and a bunch of other stuff. And then everything we do to make our energy more expensive is going to harm our economy. And so they want that. So it's very much in China's interest for all of us to be just totally crazy about this stuff and them to keep building coal plants and all that stuff. And then, of course, fracking. So I had a debate, again, it was a very nice person, I think he was a Catholic priest, about this, and he was really worried about peak oil. It was about 15 years ago, and I was following the fracking stuff. I said, no, this is nonsense. I said, if the analysts knew we were about to run out, the price would tell you. That's all you need to know to figure out, okay, is it true that we're just about to run out of oil? Look at the gas station prices. There's a price signal. Anything that everybody on the planet wants that's almost completely scarce, that's going to be $1 billion a barrel. It's not what's happening. And so it's really, really frustrating because, even oil companies themselves sort of, you know, punish themselves because they feel like that's sort of required just for marketing purposes, because if the population thinks it's bad, then even if you're BP or Exxon, you got to sort of signal that you're working with the fairy dust to solve the problem. But I think there need to be other messengers and people like Epstein that say, look, it's anti-human, effectively. It might be posing as compassionate, but it's actually anti-human when you look at its effects.
What do you think of this guy?
Thanks so much.
Jay, I don't know why you came back to see to Montana the fifth time. And
I had forgotten it was the fifth time, that's why.
I know you probably came back to see me.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. Blessings.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Just a couple of things as we close. If you can help us pay for this, that would be good. Pray for America. Pray for America. Be influencers. I love all you people that come. I'm grateful for you. But we want to be people that influence other people. So be an ambassador. Be an ambassador for Christ. Be an ambassador for truth. Thank you for coming. We will see you November 8th and 9th for Dr. Dale Taggett. Blessings.